What does possibility mean to you?
That's a hard question.
Something that you can strive for.
That I'm able to do anything I set my mind to.
You're confident in yourself and you believe in yourself. Stuff that you could achieve.
I feel excited. Anything is possible when you're more confident.
Shoes are a huge part of that. They are the most important part of my style.
You can like express yourself in the right shoes.
Anything is possible.
DSW, countless shoes at bragworthy prices. Imagine the possibilities.
There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers, a dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends, a place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view, but when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it. No matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. It's Wednesday and this is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. I will be out of town all next week. I just want to remind everybody, we're going to play some of our favorite best of episodes. I know we've got a couple of our very first interviews ever with the one and only Lorraine Warren, and some of those are just gems, amazing interviews. As a matter of fact, our first interview we did, Ed Warren was still alive. He was unfortunately in a comatose state, but he was there at the house while we were doing the interview. And we really kind of dipped into their history and background. And it was such a beautiful story and interview. Afterwards, I remember Lorraine telling me how she really enjoyed that interview because usually it's so focused on Amityville or the paranormal aspects. And we really dug into her background and Ed's background. And she, you know, it was kind of when Harry met Sally, we got this beautiful story of the two of them coming together. I mean, it's still filled with paranormal encounters and stories, but it was just something a little different. But we've got some of those episodes. I think we've got a couple of Dan Aykroyd episodes and a couple other little gems that'll be popping up. That's next week while I'm gone. But we do have a brand new True Crime Tuesday coming up next week. And I mentioned this the other day. I want to make sure that you guys are aware of this. We have a contest. Well, not even a contest. We just have a cool drawing going on. If you sign up for True Crime Tuesday right now, anybody that signs up between now and September 1st. So everybody that signed up from now till September 1st, going all the way back to our first signups, we're going to do a random draw of three names. We'll announce those names on September 1st or 2nd, whatever the program allows. And we will be giving away 3 one-year subscriptions to True Crime Tuesday. So you'll be able to get an entire year of True Crime Tuesday for absolutely free. And all you have to do is sign up now. And the beauty of True Crime Tuesday, if you like our show on Beyond the Darkness, True Crime Tuesday has been a deep aspect of our show for 5 years. We've still got it going. We've got it available through Patreon. It's $5 a month. That's only $1.25 per 90-minute to 120-minute episode. You get 4 of those every month, guaranteed. Brand new episodes for you. We get some of the best true crime stories, including some dumb crimes and stupid criminals for you. So if you go sign up, make sure you sign up now between now and September 1st. We'll do that drawing. We'd love to get up to 2,500 followers on that page, and we're about 1,400, 1,500 in, so it's not going to take much to get us there. If you've been on the fence thinking about it, considering it, I ask you at least give it a one-month try. See for yourself if you like the show, and I'm sure once you get it, and you can access those shows any day of the week, even though the brand new ones come out every Tuesday, you can listen any day of the week, and it gives you access to all of our archives of True Crime Tuesday with Patreon. So go sign up. You do that by going to darknessradio.com. Click on the True Crime Tuesday banner, and then you sign up and subscribe. It's that simple. It's that easy, and then every Tuesday, you're alerted to the brand new episodes that are available to you. So go check that out and sign up right now for a chance to get a free one-year subscription. And remember to go to podcastone.com to find all of the great sponsors of Beyond the Darkness. Because of them, I get to bring you Beyond the Darkness every week, 5 days a week with limited ads at no additional cost to you. Now, if you've heard a sponsor that you want to try out, or say you forgot a sponsor and you want to see the list, you can access them by clicking on the Killer Deals button at Podcast One. Then visit the Beyond the Darkness page. You'll see the banner for Beyond the Darkness. Click it. And I only approve sponsors who make sense for our audience. And each of the sponsors are listed there with the banners linked to the promotional deal and the promos listed by the brands. Everything you need, easily accessible in one place. So thanks to our sponsors and thanks to all of you for supporting them. In addition, Beyond the Darkness is a participant in the Amazon Associates program, an affiliate advertising program designed to provide a means for me to pay fees for our show and our background costs for this one to keep us floating as well. So by linking to Amazon.com and affiliated sites, you'll be able to help support your pals here at Podcast One and Beyond the Darkness. So check that out again. Go to PodcastOne.com, click on the Killer Deals link. Then you'll find the Beyond the Darkness banner. Click on that to find all of our advertisers. And those are great ways to keep us afloat and support our show. Speaking of our show, it's time to get into our show. And tonight, we're going to do a little monster talk. It's a science show about monsters. And joining us for the evening is Blake Smith. He is the host of the show. And it is a science-themed podcast that explores science topics using monsters as a springboard. And it's great to have you with us, Blake. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me, Dave. I'm a longtime listener as well.
How dare you? What kind of tone is that? You bring that podcast attitude to my show? You've been so kind in working with us, and I know we've tried to schedule this a couple times, and timing was off and equipment was off. I'm just teasing with you, but I appreciate you coming on here and being with me tonight. And you're a skeptic. Now, is that a capital S skeptic or a kind of a, well, I'm kind of skeptical?
I'm a capital S skeptic, but not an a-hole skeptic, hopefully.
We've got 2 days of skeptics back to back here. We talked with David McAfee yesterday talking about many different aspects of the paranormal and faith healing and cults and things like that. So it's kind of a refreshing week to take a different look and an angle at a lot of the topics that intrigue us. And in all honesty, Blake, I found a really bizarre trend. With as popular as all the ghost shows are and UFO shows, the monster shows that we do, whether it's Dogman, Chupacabra, Bigfoot, Nessie, any of these creatures, they seem to go through the roof. People are really intrigued and fascinated by the aspect of monsters. Why do you think they're so intrigued by that?
I think monsters, they represent a way to explain some of the strange phenomena that people see. So they have an explanatory power, but they also, they just capture our imaginations. And I think if you think about the history of, you know, what are popular monsters and myth and legend, sometimes they're just giant versions of animals or giant versions of people. And are they're sort of hybrids, chimeras, where you mix different animal parts, or maybe they're just the unknown and the unexplained. The history of the word, I think it has the same root as demonstration, the monstrum. So they've always had an explanatory power. So that's part of it, I think. But don't we all have these fears of the unknown? And when we have the unknown out there making us scared, we're going to fill it up with something. And so I think we all have a natural proclivity towards creating monsters. And certainly we love telling stories about them. And who doesn't love to be scared as long as it's not really going to kill us, right?
So. Well, but we don't know that because a lot of these stories, you know, we used to just hear of Bigfoot encounters and the occasional howling Bigfoot or throwing rocks at you Bigfoot. But it seems as time has progressed, we've gotten into more darker Bigfoot encounters where Bigfoot seems to be terrorizing people, families, animals. Why do you think there's this aggressive turn in the history and legend and lore of this creature?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I think there's this pattern that happens when you have monsters that you get these. First, there's the story, right? So is the story a claim, a sighting, or is it a legend? You know, you kind of have to filter that and figure it out. But Bigfoot stories in particular, you know, they come out of the 1950s, the classic Bigfoot, sort of American version of the Yeti. And I think skeptics – I hate to just jump into the it's not that, it's this sort of explanation, because I think skeptics have a reputation for dismissing all of these things with little, you know, it's not a UFO, it's swamp gas. That's kind of the classic example. But the reality is, I think a serious skeptic who's really looking into these things will tell you, you've got to look at each case and look at what's being claimed and what the evidence is, and then go from there to sort of decide. But these are also the conveyance of these things, the stories. It's not really usually a photo or a recording that really gets the thing spreading across our culture. It's the story. And if the story of I saw something is not interesting enough, it's natural that there's going to be some sort of mutation in those. So I think from a cultural perspective, it's there's going to be all sorts of things because, yeah, you hear the stories about the hazards of Bigfoot or Bigfoot's coming and stalking you. But I mean, there's other stories that are also creeping up out there. This sort of, I mean, there's Bigfoot erotica, there's Bigfoot fiction. There are lots and lots.
I love how you mix up or you separate Bigfoot erotica and Bigfoot fiction.
Well, I don't want to be pedantic, but you know, what I mean is there's formal fiction, and then I think within that fiction, there's subsets of erotica apparently. Which, don't Google this, people. I'm just telling you what exists. You'll be shocked. I found out even Audible has Bigfoot erotica. I've not downloaded any, and please don't check my search history. So,
You should, because I get paid a lot of money for every one of those stories I read. So make sure you check out Dave's monster baiting series.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what I've been calling it. No, here's something, and I'll tell you what. I'll play the skeptic on this. I'll play the skeptic on this, Blake. I think I know why stories are getting more aggressive.
Okay.
The skeptical nature of me says, because nobody cares if you were driving down the road and you saw a Bigfoot stride across the road and disappear into the woods.
Yeah, that's where I was heading. I think it's being
right.
Amped up.
It's fascinating. Oh, great, you had that contact. But we've heard that. We've been there. We've done that. But now Bigfoot's coming over to our house and looking in our windows. Okay, we've heard that. That's kind of creepy. That's weird. Now they're throwing rocks at us. Well, Bigfoot has crappy aim because he can never hit anybody. He can hit the roof of the house, but he can't hit anybody with a rock. But he's just trying to scare him off. But that's another new element. And when that doesn't garner enough attention, then it's, you know, they're shaking my car. They're you know, tearing my dog apart limb by limb. And it starts to get into that. And I'm not saying that that's fake fact for everyone. You know, I believe that some people, if they have truly encountered these creatures, they may be aggressive. And if you've caught the creature, maybe between their child and themselves, maybe they are more aggressive like most animals would be, or if you've startled them, I can understand them being more intimidating or creepy or trying to scare you out of their territory if these creatures do exist. So I can understand there being kind of that, but I've noticed in even doing the show, it seems that the aggressive nature certainly gets a lot more attention. When we do a Bigfoot show, we'll get 200,000 downloads. When I do the dark side of Sasquatch, you know, Bigfoot attacks, I will suddenly get 500,000 downloads of that same episode.
Neat.
So people like, yeah, so now you know how to sexy up your show, right?
I've just learned a new topic. I need to cover.
And then don't even get me started with the seduction of Sasquatch episodes, man. We were like 2.5 million downloads of those, but then you gotta get a figure in on how you can find that on the black web or the dark web or whatever it's called. It's fascinating to me watching the paranormal explode and the relevance of these cases and stories and allegations of you know, ghosts and demonic and fairies and creatures and black-eyed kids. Everything is getting more and more amped up, and it's easier to do that now. We're a creative world. People are creative. They understand that even in a normal story we tell, there's little embellishments here and there. So when you come to the fantastic, it only seems plausible that the fantastic becomes even more fantastic in the eyes of the person telling the story, because you're already taking a topic that's out of the norm of reality and, you know, blowing it up even more with your excitement and passion, and maybe the roar lasted a little longer in your telling than it actually occurred in real life. So it's hard to say in some of those aspects, but I'm curious where your thoughts are on this. Being a skeptic, why even delve into the world of monsters and continue a podcast about them if it's something that you're not even really a believer or follower of?
Yeah, it's I think because for most of my life, I was fascinated and interested and hopeful that I would encounter some of these things, you know, and they had more than just an entertainment value. You know, I was passionate about knowing more about the world and the mysteries therein. Right. So I think that's what drove it. It's kind of a part of natural curiosity. I think maybe that's why everybody loves monsters, because most people like a mystery, and most people like knowing that the world is maybe a little more interesting than they thought it was, you know? What happened is, I think for myself at least, after years and years of reading about monster claims and monster stories, I got really interested in the question of, are they real? You know, is this, I mean, I know there's stories, people say they've seen them, but are they real? Like, what's the evidence? And in that journey, I encountered this world of skepticism. And I say world of, I mean, I've encountered sort of the concepts of scientific skepticism, which really, it's not what a lot of people think. Skeptics, let me just define this, right? So for me, skepticism is about using the scientific method to filter out what's real and demonstrably true versus what might be true, right? So it's a way of filtering evidence. And I guess one of the things that happens is people say, well, you know, I saw what I saw. You can't really refute that, right? And I wasn't there as a skeptic. I didn't see it. I wasn't there. And if I had been there, maybe I would think I had seen it. But when you do years of research into this, what you find out is that the human brain is really complicated, and perception is not as simple as we think about it. Intuitively, we kind of believe everything we see, and we believe what we hear. That's just, you're naturally going to believe those things. That's your senses. But, you know, psychology is increasingly telling us that, you know, that's not really how things work. You see things, and then your brain sort of creates an image or creates a truth out of it. We're not video recorders. And that's really, what do you call it? It's a mechanical sort of deconstruction of the world, and it's kind of disappointing. And so it gives skeptics a bad name if they say, well, that you can't prove that, and that's not real. And for me, as a fan of these topics, I can't really just – I don't want my show to be – that's not real, and that's not real. Tune in next week to find out what else is not real, you know? So, but what you can do is take these really fascinating topics, tell the stories, talk about what we know is plausible within science, and talk about what science says might be an explanation. But I don't want to be one of those people, and I hope I never turn into one of those people who say, you know, Mothman was an owl. And that's it. That's the end of the story. Because if you read the literature about Mothman, it's a lot more complicated than that simple story. People saw a lot of different things. And it's just like a ghost story. If someone tells you they have a haunted house, you know, well, they've given you the explanation, right? Now you kind of find out what the symptoms are. But the skeptic would say, well, don't tell me you have a haunted house. Tell me what's going on that makes you think that. And then look at each of the individual phenomena and see if there's other explanations. But it's just a different way of approaching these stories.
That's what most investigators, true investigators, do. When people start off with that, that's my first course of action. Now, I'm a skeptical believer. I've had my own experiences. I question my own experiences, and I question the stories of others. And it's good. Again, I like to really push that fact. You should be asking questions. We should be trying to get to the bottom of this and not just accept everything upon face value of the story. The stories are fascinating. There's no doubt. But what is the mindset of the person? When did it take place? You know, it is funny when I talk to a lot of people and suddenly I hear, yeah, I just come back from the hospital. I'd fallen down a flight of stairs and banged up my knee, and I was just about ready to fall asleep. I was on some Percocet and some Flexerol, and suddenly I heard something moving in my closet and lights were moving. And you're like, oh, man, well, did you ever have that happen before the Percocet Flexerol cocktail? No. All right. Well, in getting to the bottom of those type of questions, I think is really an important aspect of what we do when we're fleshing out these stories to begin with.
Sure. But another thing is there's a lot of really weird things that happen that are perfectly natural, but that seem paranormal. That's the other thing that kind of I has affected my thinking. You know, I've had sleep paralysis, and that is one of the most terrifying things that can happen to you. And if you're a person who already is inclined to believe in the paranormal, and suddenly you find yourself held down in the darkness, and you can clearly feel something has crawled on top of you and is holding you down. Mm-hmm. You know, it's absolutely terrifying. So, you know, before I sort of learned about sleep paralysis, you know, I did all the things a person would normally do when that happens. Oh, I think I'm being haunted. I'll go look at the ghost literature and see what's going on. Nope. It matches every symptom. I'm being haunted, right? So time to get the smudging ceremony, time to call the priest, you know, see if we can get this ghost out of here, right? But then it didn't go away. And, you know, I suffered for 2 or 3 years like that in trying to figure out why I was being haunted. Why was the ghost following me around? You know, that sort of thing. And then when I learned about sleep paralysis and learned about some of the other things that could potentially be causing the sort of additional symptoms I was experiencing, I found that almost everything that happened to me, despite it fitting into the haunting categories, had a plausible, naturalistic explanation. Now, that doesn't mean anybody else's ghost story is that thing, and I'm not trying to dismiss anybody's ghost story. I'm just saying that when you break it down by symptoms and by particular phenomena, sometimes you can get a different conclusion. But being haunted was a lot more fun of a story. It was a cooler story, and it was exciting. It's just that when it's actually, you know, you're being attacked, it's no fun. And that's not what I would want to have it to anybody. And I think I know for a fact, we've talked about sleep paralysis on the show and had listeners call in and say, I had never heard of this. Oh my gosh, that explains what's been going on with me for years. You know, and I was really lucky because when some people have the sleep paralysis, they get hypnagogic illusions or hallucinations that go with it. So they, not only do they just feel something on top of them, but they see things in the room. And, you know, that's a perfectly natural thing to happen, but it feels absolutely supernatural. And if you happen to like be viewing the world from a sort of perspective that has dark evil entities everywhere, this is absolute confirmation that that's true. And you know, how can you argue with that with the science? I mean, that's no fun. But
well, talk to us about that for sleep paralysis and for listeners that may not be familiar with it. It's you wake up and have this sense, and it's not usually you're laying there falling asleep and this happens to you. It's you're usually stirred and woke up and you can't move.
Exactly.
You can't really draw in a breath.
Right. You feel a tremendous pressure. So you feel a pressure on you. As I said, some people see shadowy people or demonic images or aliens. They see a lot of different things, but you can't move. You feel terrified. I usually feel like there's absolutely some evil entity watching me, but I've never seen anything. And it's just terrifying. And eventually it will pass and end, but it you can't really tell how long it's taking. And it's just an absolutely disturbing sensation. But the real reason it's happening is when you go to sleep, you may have seen a dog take a nap and suddenly you see it's moving its legs like it's running. We get paralyzed while we sleep so we don't act out our dreams. And when that gets out of sync, you can wake up still in a dream state, but you can't move. And as you're sort of halfway into dreaming, halfway out, it creates this terrifying sensation that you're being held down by a force. The historical monsters that are associated with this are the old hag syndrome, which is sort of a ghostly figure of an old woman who sits on you, incubus and succubus. Some people imagine cats get on your chest and suck your, you know, soul out, that sort of thing. There's a lot of supernatural explanations for it, but ultimately the naturalistic explanation would be that you have just gotten out of sync between your natural sleeping paralysis and your conscious state. And we actually interviewed a specialist on this fairly recently who's got a nice scientific book out about the topic. And the number one cause is having your sleep cycles messed up. So most of the time I was having sleep paralysis was when I was working really weird shifts in the Navy. So I would have like 24 on and 48 off duty. And that really messes with your sleep. And if you're like working crazy hours or swing shifts, that sort of thing, these are the most common causes. So if you can get like a regular sleep schedule, that's probably the easiest way to get rid of it. But if you're having this, I would recommend talk to your doctor because there may be other things you can get to sleep studies and that sort of thing. But
right. And are you a back sleeper?
That's an excellent question. Yes. Most of the time, yes. I've had it once when I was on my side, but most of the time, yes. I've never had it when I was sleeping on my stomach, but I've kind of quit doing that.
Right. The interesting fact of this, and we've talked about it on the show as well, and I'm not a believer in the paranormal aspect of sleep paralysis. It is that chemical that's being pumped out from the brain to keep you from running in place or punching your lover, right, while you're in these dream states. And if you come out of it, the cat knocks something over and you wake up, and people have that sense that they can't breathe for like 2-3 minutes. And I always tell my listeners and people in live programs, hold your breath for just 30 seconds. At what point do you start thinking, I want to take a breath, I want to take a breath? And usually it's like 15 to 20 seconds in. And most of these sleep paralysis moments really don't last more than 20 to 30 seconds at most.
Yeah.
And then the body's back into a normal pattern and you're able to breathe. You're able to kind of regain consciousness and awareness of all of your body parts. And then suddenly that sensation is gone. And I thought it was fascinating. We had a couple of guys on our show, gosh, probably like 2009, 2008, who did a whole documentary on it. And their findings were that it was paranormal, even though it could be treated with medication and it could be treated simply by sleeping on your stomach or side for the most part. It was really people that took naps and, like you said, had disrupted sleep patterns and people that slept on their back. Those were the people that seemed to have the majority of these experiences. And I try to rationalize with my listeners and people at live events, if it's a paranormal event, why does it only happen when you're on your back? Does the demon walk in to steal your breath and see you rolled over and decide they don't want to steal the air from that end?
Yeah. <You know>?
Yeah. And they're like, I'll pass on this one. Right. Yeah. Or they come into your room ready to steal your breath and they realize you've taken medication and they're like, nah, I don't want doped up breath. It makes no sense. If it can be treated, and it's probably more of a sleep disorder or a neurological disorder, and like you said, it's important. Go to the doctor, get that checked, because you don't know where that could take you. And sleep studies are usually covered by most insurances. And you may be dealing with a much more dangerous real-life problem like sleep apnea.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. I want to talk monsters with you. I want to get in-depth on some of the creepy stuff that people talk about. And you know, I know one of the points you brought up was Loch Ness. And that's something that's fascinated me. I mean, I remember watching In Search Of, and I saw that speedboat clipping along the water, and all of a sudden it suddenly bangs into something and flips into the air, and people all mention the fact that it was Nessie that it hit and sent that boat flying. And I don't know if you've seen that particular piece of footage.
Yeah, yes, I have. Yes.
But that's what really, I was like, what? And then, of course, the famous black and white photograph of that head and long neck poking out of the water. You know, that's something that's been burned in our consciousness and in pop culture. So it's something that fascinates people because of the concept of, could there be a living dinosaur still on Earth? And it's easy to say that, why not? There are so many different species found, especially in water, that we're unaware of. Why not believe that this is what could possibly be existing? You actually went at this in a neat scientific route by talking to paleontologists and scientists on this, right?
That's right. I love Nessie. I mean, I grew up watching In Search Of, and I was always fascinated. The 70s were a really great time to be a kid because there was Guinness Book of World Records, Ripley's Believe It or Not, In Search Of, That's Incredible. There were just all these different shows that really would, you know, share mysteries, and Nessie was definitely one that just captured my imagination. I was so interested in some of the scientists who were looking into it because in the 70s, it felt like there was just a tremendous amount of interest in doing scientific research into what this creature was, right? Or what these creatures were. They would have to be more than one if there was going to be a naturalistic explanation, right? There'd have to be a breeding population. But what we decided to do on the show was we looked at the historical context of it, but I thought from a science perspective, if you're talking about Nessie, I mean, the classic view is what they call the surgeon's photo. That's the photos everybody's seen of the sort of black shadowy creature on rippling water. And it was thought at the time that it was probably a plesiosaur, which is I hate to say it, but it's not a dinosaur. It's a Mesozoic marine reptile. That's one of the first things I learned while doing the show was I always bring on scientists and they know more than me by quite a bit. And one of the lessons you get hammered into you is don't call it a dinosaur, call it a Mesozoic marine reptile. Same thing with pterosaurs. They're not dinosaurs either, but I'm not a paleontologist. You'll have to look up the explanation for why that is. It has to do with their bone structure, but anyway. So we had on a paleontologist to talk about plesiosaurs, and I just learned so much. One of the big things I learned was that their entire life cycle was in the water. They gave live birth despite being reptiles. So if you think about reptiles today that live in the water, like turtles and snakes, I think for the most part, they come on shore and lay eggs. And then when the eggs are hatched and they have to have heat for hatching, then they crawl back into the water, right? But these animals actually mated and gave birth in the water. And another thing was that they like birds, they had gastroliths. So they would eat stones to help them digest their food. And it's just kind of fascinating to me because that's two very specific pieces of biological information about an animal that no one's ever seen alive, right? That in the scientific method helped people, you know, learn these things through a lot of different kinds of research and avenues of investigation. And there's just so much that expertise can tell you about these creatures, you know, what kind of food they eat, how much they would have to eat to sustain their body size. And then you can take that information and look at the lake and say, does this lake have enough, you know, biomass to support a sustainable population of this size, that sort of thing. And there's other things, like the lake used to be frozen under a glacier, you know. That's not a really good habitat for marine reptiles. They really don't like being frozen in ice. it's not healthy for them. If you have marine reptiles at home, don't freeze them. They hate it. So
yeah,
that sort of thing. But we could have just said a lot of things about why we don't think Nessie is real, why it's not a real animal. But I thought it was more constructive to say here's some reasons why we doubt it. But hey, you know that animal everybody says it is? Let's find out what that really was like. And because they're fascinating creatures. They look so cool. And when I go to museums now and I see skeletons of plesiosaurs, I have a lot more respect for what kind of an animal that was than I did before when I just thought, that looks like Nessie, you know? It's neat.
And you know what is funny to me, Blake? Right, here's science describing these creatures during their time era. And it's not like we found a complete one. We don't, you know, we haven't found one frozen in a block of ice that we can say this is how they worked. We've dissected them. We know they did this. And I actually catch myself questioning more about science's theories regarding dinosaurs than I sometimes do about people's experiences witnessing cryptozoological beasts. Because I always, like you said, first of all, how do we know what color they were? We're not finding skin. How do we know that they, you know, what they ate, how they ate? I know in some cases you can tell by the teeth and the wear of the teeth pattern. And there are some of those little bits that maybe give away the information for you. But I've been fascinated with the fact that people are quicker to dismiss science because I think a lot of this stuff is guesswork, even in the science world.
Yeah, that's such a really important topic. Okay. Especially right now, it seems like a lot of the whole world is, I don't want to get into politics at all, but it just seems like questioning sources is this year's top topic, right? How can we know this is true, right? And there's this other sort of very American thing about not really respecting expertise. We don't like to be told by, you know, eggheads what's what, right? We want good hard facts. We don't want what some theory, some smarty pants from a university tells us, right? And what I've learned over the course of these almost 10 years of doing this show is that expertise is way far away from certitude. It's about this arduous journey of hammering away at theories and trying to figure out what can we find that will disprove this. And the things that filter through and the things that become consensus have really gone through a war of ideas and been tested in lots of different ways. And any of that can be overturned if you can find contrary evidence that'll support a new hypothesis, right? But these experts that come out and say, well, these animals ate this kind of food, and yet you're looking at rocks, right? Fossils are rocks.
Right.
Right? So, they're not, a lot of times, they're not really guessing. They've got really interesting evidence. But it's hidden inside these papers that are full of expert terms that they have to use to be precise. And it's really hard to find someone who can take that deep, really wonky science expertise in these papers and turn it into something digestible and understandable and trustworthy and believable for the average layman on the street. And I think most of us just have to push the I believe button and say, well, I think it's true. But then you run into science journalism, which then takes those papers and tries to distill them and usually does a terrible job of it. So instead of learning some like subtle difference in how one protein worked on a population of 1,500 people in some test, you learn that chocolate makes your sex life better or some ridiculous result that had nothing to do with what's in the paper. So it's a hard war and there's no quick solution. And I don't know except to say that I trust the expertise of scientists more than myself. but I love seeing how these things play out.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And we've got a lot more. No, that's a great answer. We've got a lot more to discuss, a lot more to talk about. I've got more to talk about. Blake's going to stick with me for the remainder of the show. We've got more Monster Talk heading your way right here on Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Blake Smith, my guest. He's the host of Monster Talk, a science-themed podcast that explores science topics using monsters as a springboard for their show. And we've been talking about some Bigfoot and Loch Ness, and you know, let's continue journeying into some of the weirder monsters and what it is that you bring to the table with your shows that, you know, are kind of enlightening. And have you ever been surprised by information on a cryptid that you might be investigating?
Sure. And we do stretch out into a lot of monsters. I think some of the classic cryptids, we'd run out pretty fast, but we've been doing it for about 9 years now. So, one of the more interesting ones, Slenderman is very interesting to me because we know Slenderman was created, on the Creepypasta website. It was a art contest to make a scary picture, but then people started actually seeing Slenderman, and there's this idea of tulpas as I guess in America we tend to think of them in terms of using shared thought or will to sort of bring something to life, and that idea, it turns out, comes from Theosophy, which in turn borrowed it from Buddhism in Tibet. And so when we were talking about this topic, we brought on some religious studies people who had actually studied Buddhism and looked into this idea of tulpas. And it turns out that what's happened is the idea of tulpas in Buddhism is really, really different. It would have nothing to do with what it's become to mean culturally in the U.S. or even, I guess, in the West, you might say. And so that was one of the things that surprised me is again, this idea happens again and again and again in all these monsters, whereas there's ideas that get transformed and shared and they mutate over time so that over the course of a monster's sort of life in our culture, it becomes different things at different times. A good example would be Chupacabra.
Let's stick on Slenderman for a minute, if you don't
mind.
Sure, yeah. And talking about the differences in tulpas. First of all, can you break it down for us of what the current understanding of tulpa is compared to what the historical story and significance of that term meant?
Well, I think I'm hesitant to make definitions because, you know, everybody tends to sort of make their own definition. But the way it's sort of perceived in general, I think, could be defined as it's sort of like the secret for monsters, which I mean, like the idea that you use force of will and because enough people believe in a thing, that thing becomes true. And that's it's a really common idea, the idea that if enough people believe it, it just happens. And there's plenty of reasons why that can sort of be true about things in your life. If you really focus on an idea, maybe you want to be, you know, get a raise or something, or become a manager or start your own company or write a book. Believing in yourself is a really important step. You know, having strong faith in that idea that you can actually accomplish it is important. What's kind of lost is that there's a lot of work that has to go into that too. And so it's not just the belief, it's the other stuff. But the idea that you would take the force of will of a population and be able to make a monster come true, that's an idea that existed in fiction, but sort of outside of the tulpa. There's some really classic old radio shows I listened to where they had an idea that enough people were listening to the radio show and believed that a house was haunted, that it became haunted when the investigator was going into it. That was a great one. But the idea is that people believe in Slenderman and they make him come true. Like they enough people believe in this fictional creature that he manifests physically. That's the idea of the tulpa. But in Buddhism, it's more about the idea of, and I don't want to mess this up because this is an important religious belief for these people, and it's, I don't mean to dismiss it or say anything wrong about it. I'm just saying that it's an entirely different idea. It has more to do with about the idea of the Buddha himself being incarnate as a thought form. And so that's very specifically tied to Buddhism and to the Buddha, which is not Slenderman. I mean, they're really, they've nothing to do with each other. You know, it would be almost the equivalent of someone saying, well, it's transubstantiation. I mean, basically, you know, my Pepsi turns into Diet Coke. That's transubstantiation. That's not what transubstantiation means. You know, you're basically taking their term and repurposing it for your own belief. And that's what's happened with tulpas.
What I was fascinated by with the story of Slenderman was, as you said, we can kind of trace its origins to this creepypasta site and what was going on with that. But when we started talking about that, I was able to actually track. There are many different encounters with a being similar to Slenderman, tall, long, lanky, no face, sometimes has these spider-like legs that come out of their back, through different religions and cultures, through time. And it seems cyclical in nature. And I always wonder, what are the triggers to bring these beings back out of the darkness, if you will? Whether they're fact or fictional, it just seems intriguing to me that there is a cyclical pattern that creatures like this kind of rear their ugly head again through history.
Yeah, that's true. Although I think if you think about biology, right, there's this concept in evolution called convergent evolution where you get like for Australia, here's the one that's easy to go to. In Australia, they had these things called Tasmanian tigers. They look like wolves. They're, as far as we know, they're extinct now. People still see them, but we believe they've all been killed out by humans, yay us. But they look like a canid, but they're a marsupial. And if you look at the molecular data and if you look at the history of the continent of Australia, they're not really related to dogs or wolves in any way anytime recently. But these ideas of this convergent that there's a niche in nature that needs to be filled, it fills it with something that can do the job. And I think that's a natural process. Basically, there's selective pressures that push creatures to get designed this way. But in humans, we have ideas that get shared, and some of them seem to be sticky, and I don't know why. And if anybody did know why and could like reliably make sticky ideas, well, they'd be in advertising, wouldn't they? But they'd be millionaires. But in monsters, there's some stories that are really catchy and everybody knows about them, and they come up again and again in different cultures, even when there may not even be a reason why that would be true. The hairy man, there's going to be a hairy man in every culture. You know, you can't get me to believe realistically that Bigfoot exists in England, but people see him there. People see him in Hawaii, which is crazy. If he's a real natural creature, that would never happen because these places are completely separate, right? There's no way that the species could get a population there to grow. So it doesn't have a naturalistic explanation. But what is in common in all those monsters is people are there, and people carry ideas, and ideas can cross an ocean on a boat with one person. And you can take an entire belief system and all kinds of fantasies and artwork and ideas. And any one little person can carry just millions and millions of seeds for ideas that will spread among other people and other people. And I can never let go how fascinated I am by that and proud, because I love being human. I love that's part of one of the great things about us is we're so creative. But as to why we share these ideas and why we share these experiences, whether they're real or not, I don't know, but there's something really incredibly human about the process, and I love it.
I'm fascinated by the stories surrounding cryptids, and especially when it comes to the Bigfoot, because there are so many different variations of these beings that exist in, like, the native cultures. Not just the white man's approach to these stories, but the native cultures in Hawaii and throughout the Americas and Mexico, Canada. It's just, to me, that's what's so intriguing, that they just kind of accept that these beings do exist. And, you know, I know as somebody who's a skeptic, I'm sure you've had it thrown in your face 1,000 times. Well, remember, 150 years ago, they thought gorillas were a myth.
It's a classic.
And you can't find bones and bodies of gorillas either. But it took a while, and finally, once that glass ceiling broke, then we now know about gorillas. and they are just a de-evolved version, right, of Bigfoot. I saw something I can't explain when I was a child that did not look human, and it looked what would be kind of the quintessential Bigfoot when I was a kid. I've examined those stories myself, and I question my own eyewitness account of it and what happened, but I still keep coming back to, I don't know. And I think we don't give enough credit to the fact that there are creatures, I think, great and small, that have a great cloaking ability, natural cloaking ability, to kind of be there in plain view, and you just will never notice them because it's not part of what you expect. So we may be passing Bigfoot more often than we ever believe, but they're sentinel, they're quiet, they're just there. You know, there's also the idea that, you know, as you said, ships can carry stories and thoughts and beliefs all over. It doesn't mean that maybe at some point cultures didn't bring these things to different areas as well.
Yeah, that's a good counterpoint, and people see them. So, I mean, those stories are going to survive the skeptics. I mean, let's just be honest. I mean,
right.
And that's fine. I'll tell you one of the reasons why I have come to doubt the existence of Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I say one. There's several. And here's one of the big ones. It has to do with science and the advancements in DNA analysis, right? Mm-hmm. So there's been lots and lots and lots of people who have claimed to see Bigfoot. But, you know, 50 years ago, seeing Bigfoot would be, okay, I saw him and there's my story. But now we have the ability to go back into an environment where people say they saw something, and we can look at, were there any hairs left? Was there any spore or poop or whatever you want to call it left? And if we could find any of that, then we'd be able to get DNA evidence. And one of the very first guest on our show was Todd Disattel, who's kind of, most people who like monster shows are going to know him because he's the biologist with a mohawk, right? So he's an anthropologist who specializes in primate DNA. And he's more than happy to come on to Bigfoot shows and do analysis of these items. But it goes more than that. So part of what he's done in their research with his lab is they've done a lot of work with environmental DNA. And so it's gotten way beyond bring me a hair. They can now take nets and catch mosquitoes in the woods in an area, and they can look at different insects that are blood feeders. And then they can take those animals, these insects that have blood meals, and they can do the DNA analysis and tell every animal that these insects have fed off of, right? And they can take water from a lake and look for biological traces of DNA there too. So if Bigfoot is real, it's almost supernatural how good it is at hiding. It's way beyond not being seen. It's not leaving a biological trace, and that's a tough trick. And so when, you know, I for years and years I kept hoping somebody would hit them with a car or, you know, something. And my, you know, there's big debates in cryptozoology. Should you have a kill policy? Should you kill Bigfoot? I mean, you know, you're going to have to get a body to define it as a species. One of our most recent episodes was about, how do you define a new species? How do you get it, like, actually recognized as a new species?
Oh, yeah, and don't bring up killing them, because you'll piss off the entire world. But, hey, the fact of the matter is, you can't make an omelet without cracking an egg. And until we take one down and pass it around, right?
Exactly. You've got to have a type specimen.
Right.
There has to be a recognized type specimen described in the literature. And it's you can't get around that. And you may not have – if this was a real animal, you wouldn't necessarily need to kill one, but you would need to find a body. And I, you know, there's these sort of like old – I don't know what's the right word – tropes. There's these classic canards, I guess, of why that's not true. People come up with a lot of reasons.
Well, you know, it's fascinating you bring that up. I thought I was a genius when I stumbled upon this thought a while ago, and then I spoke to some of my cryptozoological friends that said, no, we've done that before, Dave. But then the interesting aspect to me was that – they couldn't answer why they weren't able to get the evidence then. And I said, why are we taking packets of rubber cement or plaster of Paris with us out and putting it in a giant footprint and then taking that as a piece of evidence? Why are we not taking a spade with us, digging out the area where the indention is, where the footprint is, and bringing back that square of actual earth? Because, as you said, they can go in and find mosquitoes and tell you what every kind of animal that they've been in contact with. If we can do that, and you can get fingerprint DNA from somebody touching a glass, I would guess in a footstep, in a print, there has got to be dead skin cells, something that'll appear in these footprints that we should scientifically be able to say, okay, look, we did a scraping. Out of the scraping, we found human DNA, which we expected because a human interfered with it. We found rabbit, we found squirrel and a bear, but there was 5% that we just cannot explain. And I have not gotten one answer from any of my cryptozoological friends of why they haven't done a swab of the entire foot to see if there's any DNA. And then, you know, unfortunately, the answer is, you know how expensive it is to do DNA? And if they've got to do separation? And my thoughts are, there's enough real people out there and TV shows that want to prove this that I'm sure you could get a good budget if you've got a clean, what you believe to be a real big footprint, that somebody's going to be willing to pony up the money to definitively say one way or another, this is garbage. Or this is Bigfoot.
Yes, I think one of the long-running debates out there in the public is cryptozoology a science? Because it's defined as sort of the hunt for hidden creatures, right? And that in itself is a perfectly reasonable thing to be doing. But the difference is these amateurs, and I don't mean that dismissively. I'm an amateur too. I'm just acknowledging it. The if you're not trained in collecting DNA and you want to discover a new creature, you're starting with a really bad, you know, sort of starting point. You need to understand how to get good evidence that'll be recognized by science. You know, that's really the starting point. And I'm hoping that what we're doing with our show is helping to give people some more perspective on that. You know, that idea of here's another one. So I didn't really know all this when I started the show, but one of the things I've learned is in biology, it's really these sort of body types that we have. We're tetrapods. We have four limbs, and we have five fingers and five toes. That sort of body type is really strongly preserved. It breeds true, and it's within a population is extremely likely to stay that way. So you wouldn't find like a huge population of creatures that used to be five fingered and now are three, right? You tend to preserve those changes. But yet within Bigfoot research, or within the lore at least, there's three toed creatures and four toed creatures. There's all this genetic variation. If they're real, there would have to be genetic variation to account for these things. And that's not the sort of thing you read in cryptozoology monster books typically, but it's the kind of thing that we've talked about when I've learned from biologists talking on the show. So, I really feel like there's a tremendous amount of biology to be learned, you know, through using monsters to talk about them. And when I talk at schools, oh, that's just the best. Kids love monsters. And it's such a great way to talk about how to figure out if things are true or not. And again, my point's not to tell you what's true or what isn't true. It's just to give you some thinking points, some talking points. And if we could sort of get rid of those ideas like, nobody ever finds a bear body, you know, nobody ever finds a naturally killed bear. That's a Grover Krantz idea from the 70s that's just not true. You know, you go to the state of Pennsylvania, people find naturally dead bears all the time. You know, not even the ones they killed, not the ones they hit with cars. They just find dead bears. They're out there. You think people say, well
of course they do. Bigfoot's killing them.
Right. And he's just leaving little scary notes to ratchet it up some more, Dave.
That's right.
And he's calling my house and hanging up a lot. I don't know why. But out in the woods.
Hey, is your refrigerator running? You better catch it.
Oh, he got me again. So in the West Coast, people say, well, you know, bones don't preserve in the soil. You know, a skeleton would just dissolve, which is a great story. But first of all, think of Kennewick Man, which is a skull that was preserved for thousands of years. That's a really cool story. You look it up on your own, listeners. Another one is go do a Google search for bodies found in the woods in Seattle, Washington, or near Seattle, Washington, or just Washington State. Just search Washington State corpses found in the woods. Guess what? They find bodies in the woods. They find skeletized remains in the woods. They find fossils out there that, yeah, it's acidic soil.
Well, you
soil.
Better hope that nobody you love suddenly disappears, because when they check your search engine, dead bodies found in the woods is going to be one of them, and that's going to start putting you under a microscope there, Blake.
Best place to hide a body is not the Google recommending. But speaking of this variation, I was mentioning Chupacabra. These stories change. So when Chupacabra started, which I think was 96, I think, 95, 96, Madeline Tolentino in Puerto Rico. She originally described a creature that looked like a little alien. It had spikes on its back. It was very alien looking. Well, you know, that's 96. By 2006, people are seeing what is clearly some kind of a dog, and they're calling it a chupacabra, right? There's no world where what she described is a dog. Zero chance of that, right? So what's happened is people have taken that term to describe another mystery animal, and, you know,
Which is much like the Yeti, right? I mean, when they did, what was it, Jeff Corwin did the search for the Yeti. He found that it was a catch-all phrase for things people didn't know, and he'd show them pictures of some weird thing on the mountain, and he said, okay, we know this is a snow leopard, let's ask, and they'd ask the local villagers, and they'd look at it, and if they couldn't figure it out, some would say snow leopard, others would say Yeti.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of a catch-all to these creepy beings that are lurking around.
And another interesting thing is, you know, it became translated as abominable snowman, and that's not really – a much better translation would just be wild man. And guess what, Dave? Everywhere in the world there's people, there's legends of wild men, because how hard is it to come up with that monster? I mean, it's like a person, but he's wild. He lives in the woods. He lives in that cave. He lives on the mountain, you know? Monsters have a lot of roles. I mean, monsters are used to protect people, like the Kelpies and Silkies, the water horse. There's all kinds of legends about creatures that live in the lake and will get you, you know. And, well, yeah, you don't want your kids playing in the water and drowning. Tell them there's a monster in there, you know. So, I mean, then there's kids like you and me who would be like, oh, I want to go see the monster. So maybe it backfires sometimes. But they're really – they serve a lot of different purposes. Yeah.
I like the fact, too, that with these animals and these creatures, you're right. Some serve purposes of education. And look, you're doing a great thing. You know, and a lot of people ask, why are you talking to skeptics? They're just going to crap all over our... No, because I think skeptics bring a great aspect to this, and especially ones that are nice and open to dialogue like you are. You know, the idea of what you're doing, even though it's completely contradictory to what we want to believe, right? You're educating and enlightening, and you're taking a child's interest in something strange, and you're making it fascinating. And without them even realizing it, they're learning something. And it's not just empty calories. It's, okay, we can't really explain to you what Bigfoot is, but we could explain what Gigantic Pithecus is and why it's often thought of being part of this family, or, you know, I mean, whatever the angle would be. So I really respect that that's the type of work you do and that's what you bring. And I think that's a great element. In all honesty, when my kids start asking me more about some of this, I'm going to point them to your podcast to listen to so that they can hear the other side. They know Dad's Loony World with Beyond the Darkness. But what are the other aspects of this? And if they're asking questions, I like for them to have places to get resources and make their own decision.
Yeah, we try to be kid friendly. Not every episode is, and we put an explicit tag on it if it's not. You know, we don't drop F-bombs or whatever, but we do occasionally get into topics. You know, there's monsters out there that are not really child appropriate. The Popobawa in Africa Africa's not a country, but just I can't think of which country it's from. But the Popobawa is a good example of a monster whose very nature makes it inappropriate for polite conversation. So, yeah, there's creatures like that. But in general, yeah, we try to be very kid friendly. I know there's some teachers who use our episodes in class, and I think that's great.
Fancy, look at you.
Yeah. So yeah, it's fun. I love that, and if my kids would listen to it, it'd be great, but they don't. I'll tell you, as a skeptic, a parent, I have one daughter who totally thinks her house is haunted. And instead of saying, no, it's not, I was like, wow, okay, how can we figure out if that's true or not? What kind of evidence can we look for? You know, what can we do to capture the phenomena? And I think she doesn't like that. She just wants to have the ghost stories, you know. So she wants to look at a Ouija board. I'm like, fine, let's go get a Ouija board. She goes, really? I'm like, sure. Just don't tell your grandparents. And so she loves the Ouija board and her friends, and they're scared of it. I'm like, okay, when you're ready, I'll tell you how this works and what the skeptic take is on it and what the ideomotor effect is and all that sort of thing. But in the meantime, you know, have your fun, right? And so
okay,
I don't
well,
want to hold
that said, you're looking at this and you're here, let me, I can give you the scientific explanation for what could be going on or what is most likely going on. But Blake, have you ever been in a situation where you had a holy shit minute where you were doing this and all of a sudden you're like, that should not have done that or that shouldn't be possible?
You mean since becoming a skeptic or before that?
No, since becoming a skeptic, I guess, is where I'm interested. I love when the skeptics will occasionally run into something. And like Dr. Michael Shermer says, it's okay just to not know.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I went on a ghost tour in Roswell, Georgia, not Roswell, New Mexico. And
is that the one with Joe and Diana Avena?
Yeah, I believe.
Great.
I
good friends of us. Yeah, I love. Yeah, it looks like Neo from Matrix, right?
Then I think it was Diana.
Okay. Yeah, she does not look like Neo from the Matrix.
No, she did not. Right.
No.
I had to kind of put the memory back together, but I could go back and find out precisely who was her tour guide. But I believe that's right. And it was really fun. And as we approached, there's a big house there in Roswell a lot of things have been alleged to have happened there. And she said, now a lot of people notice that when they get here and they get ready to take pictures, their batteries go dead. And I'm like, ha ha. Well, I had a fully charged battery. I got ready to take a picture. And the flash went off and the photo came out blurry. I went to take a second picture and the battery came out dead. So I was like, huh, I'm not telling anybody this. Because we were like all skeptics. It was like an all skeptic ghost tour, right? And so I just put my camera in my pocket and thought, I'll have to look into this. So, you know, at that moment, it was pretty creepy. Later on, I think my eventual conclusion was that my battery just needed to be replaced because it sort of did it at home and I don't really have any, except for my daughter's allegations. There's no evidence of a ghost in my house.
Okay. Why does your daughter think that you have a ghost in the house?
Because she watches too much YouTube, Dave. That's
Wow. You are so dismissive, Blake. Have you sat down with her to try to communicate and see if you get EVP?
No, we have not done any EVP.
So well, then how dare you, sir? How dare you?
She has some very compelling reasons, all right?
Okay.
So she hears people walking when there's no one here. Well, as a matter of fact, this house does creak a lot. And I hear when I'm here alone and I know I'm alone, I hear what sounds like footsteps upstairs. So I usually work in the basement and it sounds compellingly like someone's walking upstairs. Now, if this was me before becoming a skeptic, I would be freaked out and be pretty convinced just like she is. But what I've learned over, you know, all these years of research is that there's a lot of reasons your house can make weird noises. One of the big ones is wind blowing on the side of the house. Now, there's a really cool experiment I could do, which is set up a system where I have a computer doing video above my office just all the time. And then when I hear that happening, go back and check the video and see what's happening. And at the same time, have, I think it's called an anemometer, where you have like a wind speed detector on the back of the house and collect that data and then see if there's a correlation between me hearing the sound and when the wind speed picks up. It's a lot of work. I've thought about the experiment a lot, but it happens so intermittently, I just can't quite compel myself to execute on the experiment. But if it were happening regularly, I totally would. But since it seems to be there's no periodicity to it, it doesn't keep recurring in a reliable way, I have to assume that whatever the thing is triggering it is something that's really random, and it really matches up closely with my idea about the wind. So I'm willing to let it go for now. If any other additional phenomena start happening that are really worth investigating, I'll be so delighted to be able to do a ghost investigation without having to go anywhere. It'll be great.
You know, what is kind of interesting, and I've noticed, and I've actually put a lot of people's minds at ease. They're kind of blown away when they call me. They expect me to be the ghost guy, and I'm going to come in and tell them it's a ghost or not, or... But I do appreciate that a lot of the people I speak to are open to a rational explanation. And I do try to offer up rationale before I jump to the conclusion of ghosts. And had you said, Dave, listen, can you talk to my daughter? She hears footsteps. And, you know, it's not just, and I get this, it's not just in the middle of the night, Dave. Sometimes it's in broad daylight during the day. I will hear these footsteps. And what I've told a lot of people is, you know, a lot of times they're hearing them mid-afternoon, in middle of the night. What do we know about those two points? Usually probably the hottest part of the day and the coolest part of the day. So you're going to have well-tracked paths in your house where people walk all the time, and that wood is going to expand and contract and expand and contract. And when it does it and one footstep pops, it might set off another one. So in most cases, it is probably the house settling, and it's just that temperature. And especially at night, you're a lot more aware of it because you don't have all the distractions of dogs barking outside, people mowing their lawn, kids out laughing and playing. So you're certainly a lot more aware of it. And then you might hear it and recognize it more during the day when you're home alone because it's out of the ordinary. You can't blame it on, well, I know my daughter's home or my wife is upstairs. So you've got that kind of, you know, that aspect of it as well. But I do notice that a lot of people that see it or hear those things will hear it between 1 o'clock, maybe 3 or 4 in the afternoon, and 2 to 4 in the morning. And those are right in the same wheelhouse. I mean, it's 12 hours apart, hottest day or hottest part of the day, coldest part of the day in most cases. So I think that that might, you know, be a big aspect of what people are experiencing. And I laugh when it comes to the witching hour, 3 o'clock. Okay. And I often wonder, do ghosts abide by daylight savings time?
Exactly. Right. Right. The time zones all around the world. What's the special thing about 3 a.m.? You know, so I don't know.
That's right. Because it's mocking the Holy Trinity. And
but that's what they say.
Right. Yeah. And to me, it's just silly because, again, it's middle of the night and it might be in a sleep cycle. We know that we sleep in a certain specified pattern. And
well,
it may just be that
a human construct too. The calendar is a human construct. These things, you know, it's like people worried about the Mayan calendar a few years ago. It's just like when your calendar runs out, does it mean the end of the world? Or does it mean go buy a new calendar? I mean, it's a lot of things that just don't make a lot of sense. But one more thing about the footsteps, a really low tech test would just be when nobody's here, but I keep hearing those things, throw powder all over the floor and see if there's footprints on the powder. Right. I mean, you know, now that's not something that I could do right now because my wife would kill me, but it's still it's a really simple experiment. That experiment goes back to the Bible. I mean, that's one that actually
they had baby powder in the Bible.
They put powder on the ground because people were, I guess they probably used flour. I have to go back and look at the scripture, but one of the things was there was a temple, and I think this is actually in the Apocrypha, and I want to say the Book of Enoch, but I can't remember. It's been a while since I read it. Wow, it has been like 2000 or 1993 was the last time I read those. Anyway, had a Catholic Bible, not a Catholic. Anyway, the thing was there was a temple where people were like putting offerings and the offerings were disappearing, but the temple was closed. Nobody went in and out. So how could that happen? And so the protagonist in this story puts flour down on the ground or some kind of powder down on the ground. And then they put the offerings out and they leave. And then they find that there's footprints when the offering disappears that lead to a secret door. And it's, the priests were stealing the food, right? Or they were taking away the offering, right? And so busted skepticism in the Bible, right? That's just kind of cool. it's just that same kind of principle. Here's an idea. Here's a weird thing that's happening. Here's a phenomena. How can we test it? And yes, and to some extent, I agree that I think all of us are looking for answers. I think a skeptic would say, try not to come up with a conclusion before you look at the what's actually going on, you know. And I think I worry that monsters and ghosts and these things, that's kind of an explanation. And what that even means can be a thousand different things. But, you know you're looking for a ghost, here's all the things that confirm the hypothesis. It's an entirely different thing from I'm having these 10 weird things going on. Can I figure out what's causing these 10 weird things, right? So that's the approach I like to tell people. But I don't like dismissing people's stories because these are personal experiences and I wasn't there. And it's not really fair of me to say that what you experienced was not real. But what I can say, here's a plausible explanation when there is one.
You did a show on demon dolls, right?
What?
Talk to me about haunted toys. I mean, that's something that fascinates everybody. And we've heard some really creepy stories and I've had some weird experiences. I wish you lived closer because I would love for you to do some experiments in my closet, which sounds a lot gayer than I didn't need it to be. But there, I've got some weird stuff going on in my house that's centered around a closet. And I can think of it that it's probably, you know, it does stem after I received a quote unquote haunted doll.
So in our episode, we were actually specifically working on the story of Robert the Doll, who is in a museum in Miami, and a lot of people will know him because he's been on, what's the show Zach has about haunted artifacts? I can't think of the name of his show right quick.
Yeah, I can't off the top of my head either.
But it's like he has a collection of haunted items, mm-hmm. And in this case, he borrowed Robert for one of the episodes. It's a little sailor doll, and there's this whole legend about the doll that if you come to see the doll, that you shouldn't mock it, and if you want to take a picture, ask permission. And if you don't, then you'll be cursed. And in order to get the curse lifted, you have to write an apology letter to Robert. And so the museum's got all these really cool historical artifacts and this doll surrounded by apology letters. So the funny thing about curses in general is they're one of those things that it's hard to disprove because you have this natural filtering thing, right? So if someone says, I curse you, right? Well, if they're not specific, you're going to have bad luck. Well, the next bad thing that happens to you Now it's not just a bad thing. It's a bad thing caused by the person who cursed you. And if you're going to start paying attention to that, it's kind of it's a bias towards noticing this sort of thing. And now you're afraid, oh crap, another bad thing happened, another bad thing. And you're just stacking up bad things. And what tends to happen is you tend to ignore the good things and start getting really obsessed with all the bad things that are happening. And I think that's problematic. Now, that's not the same as like people seeing dolls moving, that sort of thing. And let me be clear, I am a skeptic, but I love monsters. Like, for example, I like the Annabelle movie, right? I think those guys, was it Blumhouse? They just do really good, creepy films, right? But if you actually look at Annabelle, she's a Raggedy Ann doll, right? And so, like, the whole opening segment with them having her running around and writing things, it's like, Raggedy Ann can't even hold a pen, right? So it's the legends are always better. The legends are always better than the reality.
I doubt the company that owns Raggedy Ann was willing to license their doll to make it into a killer. Right? The real Annabelle is like a big 3-foot-tall Raggedy Ann.
Right. They've made a really good marketing decision by doing it the way they've done. All right. Now, I can't imagine a world where anyone would voluntarily buy a doll that looked like Annabelle.
I have two of them, so I don't know what you're talking about.
What? Well, I mean, you wouldn't you wouldn't get it for your favorite kid unless your kid
not my favorite kid.
Right? They've made a really creepy image, and they've done a good job with it. So, yeah. And the movies are scary. I mean, you know, they are. So, good on them. But I don't find Annabelle in real life to be particularly frightening, and I don't find Robert frightening at all. And the real story behind Robert doesn't really have a curse. That's a legend that's built up after the death of the owner. So, the disparity between the historical facts and the evidence and the sort of long-lived legend is kind of the meat that we make our show out of, right? So, yeah.
Very cool. Tell me about a couple more of your favorite episodes you've covered and topics that you really found the most fascinating.
Well, we've done a few that were on sort of literature topics. I really enjoyed talking about Cthulhu. That's a very popular episode. Ancient Aliens is an extremely popular topic. People love aliens. And I mean, whether you consider aliens to be monsters or not, that's kind of like ghosts. Some people think they're monsters. Some people think they're not. Poltergeists are good ones. But the Ancient Alien ones I find really fascinating. I don't want my show to turn into a giant archaeology show, but we've had on some archaeologists, especially Ken Fader, who's also come on to talk with us about giants. There's all these legends about giant skeletons being found in the Middle East, being found in America. I think having an archaeologist talk about some of the ways archaeology examines those claims is just, I find it fascinating because I was so ignorant about how the archaeological process works, you know, how they actually figure out what they can from the evidence, because they're basically working with people's trash and people's remains. I mean, it's just the stuff we leave behind tells a story. You don't think about it, but if you died right this second and all people could find was the crap on your desk 100 years from now, you know, they break into the ruins and they find your desk. What can they tell about you? A lot.
They're going to say, this guy needed a social life, and for God's sakes, clear your browser history, Schrader. That's what they'd think.
How did this person get any work done? Right. So,
speaking of, let me mention this, Ancient Aliens. You can watch full episodes on Ancient Aliens at history.com or in the History app. You can catch up on episodes you missed or rewatch your favorite episodes. And Ancient Aliens is the series that explores the controversial theory that extraterrestrials have visited Earth for millions of years. From the age of the dinosaurs to ancient Egypt, from early cave drawings to continued mass sightings in the U.S., each episode gives historic depth to the questions, speculations, provocative controversies, firsthand accounts, and grounded theories, in their estimation, surrounding the age-old debate. Did intelligent beings from outer space visit Earth thousands of years ago? So you can find out more about Ancient Aliens by visiting history.com/shows/ancient aliens, or just go check it out at history.com. And, you know, I do think it's a fascinating show. It's funny because I've talked to some of the people that originated the series, and they weren't happy because they feel that it's even strayed a little bit away from their comfort level and belief system. But listen, how many pieces of shows like that have you walked away from? And maybe you didn't walk away a believer, but you now know a little bit more about that era in history and time.
Oh, I think, again, they're a great springboard to look into mysteries, right, to learn more about them. I certainly don't want to – I guess my problem is there's lots of things that I don't believe in and or I'm skeptical of, as you might say, that could be flipped with right evidence, right? That's one of the hard things to do is admit you're wrong, right? And so I've been wrong so many times in my life that I've gotten used to it. So it's just like my default, well, I probably am wrong. What do you think? So skepticism's given me a way to test stuff, and I like that. If you watch something on one of those shows, it doesn't really matter what show it is, whether it's Ancient Aliens or something you see on National Geographic or PBS or whatever, use those things as a way to like find topics that you want to learn more about, and then go out there and look and see what has been done to uncover these mysteries. There's lots of mysteries that have good explanations that are not well-known explanations. And that's, I think, unfortunately, not as widely available in fun and easy to digest, you know, options like the History Channel has. So if you want to learn about an ancient temple, you know, if the temple had a legendary spider god that, you know, had a gold headdress that's, you know, amazing, you know, it may have all kinds of, you know, treasure hunter shows about it. Or if it had a curse, it might have mystery shows about it. But if it had evidence of a local culture that had been doing trade with somebody, you know, 300 miles away through the trickle trade, all this sort of idea, you know, it may be fascinating and tell us really deep stuff about the historical lives these people had and their relationship to the people who live there now. That's not good TV typically, but it's fascinating if you're willing to do the dig in on the research. So honestly, that's a mystery to me that I don't think there's an easy answer for is why do people in Hollywood believe that mysteries are better television than delivering pretty good known facts? I mean, like, why is the spooky music and that view of things so prevalent, but there's such little hard science? Because I think it's possible to teach science without being boring. And I think it's possible to make it accessible, but without being boring.
Possible. But yeah. I think here's where it runs into. And this will be rough because, I don't want to piss off my listeners or your listeners or anybody on this line. But we want to be entertained first and foremost. We want to be scared. And sometimes it's letting the air out. It's finding out the truth about a fat man in a red suit. And that kind of magic is gone. And then people get kind of jaded to the idea. Whereas if you leave it open-ended, you leave it as a what if, or, you know, I'm not going to say that it's aliens, but it's aliens, right? You kind of give that hint of that it still exists. I think that's a piece of wonder that leaves people coming back. If you just poop on it and say it's not there and you can back it up with science, okay, that's great. And then that's done. But if we do it in the right way, we can continually spoon feed you other information that keeps the series alive and interesting to viewers. You know, I get asked all the time, why do they film at night for these ghost hunter shows? And I say it's real easy. It's because it looks creepier. And night vision gives you that aliens feel of claustrophobia. And you've got that dark circle around you and you're just kind of compressed in the middle of the screen and anything could happen. And you're seeing what they can't see and what you might have the opportunity to see the ghost dart through the hall that they didn't even notice. So I think that it's part of that eliciting the interaction with the audience. And, you know, I was very proud. I worked for Ghost Adventures for a number of years as a location scout and helping with the history. And it was the history is told to by us, you know, or not told to it by us, but told to us by the people that lived it or reconciled it. And a lot of times it was us digging through and finding out what was true and what wasn't. And we were able to debunk a lot of times the history of what they thought was going on there. And you'd find out, no, that guy didn't die here. He died 2 miles down the road, or he was hung in Wyoming, not in Nebraska. And that was part of the execution. And what's funny to me is people do tell me one of their favorite aspects of the show had nothing to do with the ghost hunt. It had to do with the history and the fun way that they got it delivered to them.
Yeah, and I guess let me be clear that while I wish there was more of the better science content, it's not Hollywood's job to make that happen. It's their job to make money selling commercials, right? So it's incumbent upon the people who are, I guess, really enthusiastic about science to come up with that content and make it available. And it's out there. I mean, you go to YouTube, if you look for science content, there's plenty of it. It's just not doing anything numbers-wise like cat videos, right?
So, and I do – you know what? I've had people bitching, why don't you do more on science? And then I have a scientist come on, and they're like, God, this guy's boring. Oh, my God, yeah. This sucks. And, you know, even in posting today's show – I'll have a hard time, but I'll use the word science. But I can guarantee you by including the word science, I will take a hit of probably 50 to 60,000 listeners that won't check it out because it had the word science in it.
Why don't you make a typo and put in sexy? It's Monster Talk, the sexy show about monsters.
The sexy talk with Blake Smith. Yeah. Monster Erotica. That's what I'm going to name the episode.
I love Bigfoot. No. Right. I love Bigfoot.
I love Bigfoot babies. Bigfoot White. Oh, yeah, baby.
Yeah, it's funny, though. I mean, we've done so many episodes about these. Like, some of them are obscure monsters. Some of them are well-known monsters. And I've still got probably more than 100 monsters we haven't even talked about. And I'm delighted that we have, as a society or as a world culture, I realize it's really a bunch of different cultures, but humans love monsters. We do. I'm not even close to getting through them all. There's so many. And they're so great. And I love that. So I want to make
sure. You said you're open for the idea of having an experience. But if you had a real experience – and I mean, seriously, you hear footsteps in your house. That's still kind of an interesting aspect of this. And yeah, we can look at the fact that a house settles or could be timed to the wind. But what would it take to make Blake Smith scratch his head and say, all right, I think that's paranormal? In all honesty, wouldn't you just keep digging and trying to fact it away with science no matter what?
There is the problem. All right, so this is, if you think about it, science is a filter, right? And it basically wants to be able to find testable stuff. And the problem with the paranormal, in my experience, is that it's usually really intermittent. Whatever weird thing you experience is not reliable. If you could reliably get a ghost to appear and do whatever it does, like take the stone tape theory, right? So let's say, well, you know, each year on the anniversary of her death, she appears at midnight if you stand in this location, that kind of thing. If that was really reliably true, then it would be a scientific thing because we'd be able to see it happen and test it. But that's not how it is. You get these deeply personal experiences that you can't explain. And more importantly, from scientific perspective, it slips right past the filter because you can't reproduce it or test it. And it's heartbreaking because the people who have it happen, for a lot of them, it becomes really important that other people believe them. And as a skeptic, I barely believe stuff when it happens to me. You're right. But I don't know that I would want to just deconstruct it. It's, you know, there's things in life that you're not going to be able to explain, right? I could look at the neurological basis for love, you know, like how can I really know what's going on in someone else's head? How do I know my wife loves me? How could I really know? Like factually, I mean, she could just be pulling a fast one, right? That kind of thing. Well, some things you have to take on faith, and that'll annoy my skeptic friends. But the reality is there's things that you have to just press the I believe button and go on, right? And, I think if something really paranormal were to happen, I think the minimal kind of evidence I would be looking for would be something that I could reliably know I didn't imagine, and that's tricky, and that absolutely without question defied reality. Now, I've had the opportunity to talk to James Randi a lot of times, and I'm really happy about that. Mm-hmm. But he has brought it to bear in my mind really forefront that what you experience is not necessarily what's really going on. You want to come up with conclusions. I mean, like, you know, oh, the magician's hiding this thing. Or, you know, you're being tricked. Optical illusions are a great example. That Richard Wiseman's work will be a great reminder that your brain doesn't really give you what's there. It gives you what it tries to put together as a picture that you can understand. And that's not the same thing. It's literally there. That the blue dress, gold dress thing, you know, that the whole internet just blew up because people couldn't tell whether it was blue. Well, some people see things differently. There's this whole idea.
That was intriguing to me, though, because it depended on when I looked at it. Sometimes I saw it as blue. Sometimes I saw it as gold. And I couldn't wrap my head around why I was having that happen.
Yeah, it seems to be like there's like some genetic differences that seem to be at play. I had everybody in my family try it, and it was 2 blue, 3 gold, I think was how it played out. And the gold people didn't believe the blue people. I totally believe that they saw something different. I can only see the blue one. I don't know why. I mean, I understand that it's gold.
Try to look at it again and try to do that thing like the 3D picture where you just let your eyes.
Yeah, terrible eyes. So, yeah.
Yeah, and that helped me, and all of a sudden I'd notice it. But that was funny. It's like once it popped into that other color, I couldn't see it the other way again. And yeah. I'd have to take it down and then go look at it a couple days later, and it'd be the gold one still, and then I'd have to refocus my eyes, and all of a sudden it was blue, and then I couldn't get it back to gold, and I couldn't figure out what the hell was I doing. Because at first I thought, some moron has just posted a blue dress and a gold dress, and they're posting the same dress with these different colors, and people just keep passing it around and fighting over what color they see. And this is what's going on, but I was actually having the experience with both. So it is interesting how our brains and our eyes can fool us. And you know, I hear this all the time too. Dave, I see shadow people. Where? And I'm curious, Blake, when people report to you visions of shadow people, where do they usually see them?
In my experience, it's usually in the bedroom.
Right, but usually they see them out of the corner of their eye.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I tell people that's the worst place to see anything because there's so few cones and rods in that area that our mind is tricked. And most people see these shadow people in low light settings. And usually while they're in the living room at night watching TV and they see something out of the corner of their eye, and when they turn their head, it's gone. But they're not realizing the flickering light patterns are constantly changing from the TV or whatever your computer screen. And it will give you these false impressions of something moving because your mind is filling in the space.
Yeah, well, I think other things may be going on too because I've
no, seen a it's exactly person. That. I'm right.
No, it's like, I'm right. I've seen a shadow person, Dave. I've seen one.
Wait, what? You're a skeptic.
Yeah, but I've seen a shadow person. It was pretty cool. But
hang
it's
on,
cool
wait a
now.
Minute. Hang on. Wait. Yeah. Sorry, James Randi is texting me and says he wants his skeptic card back, and Michael Shermer just spit on your picture. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You're out of the club now.
We are an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine.
I know,
right?
I'm aware of that. As a matter of fact, we're including a link to your podcast and that page at Skeptic Magazine. Please go check it out, folks.
MonsterTalk.org in case we get divorced. Like, I admit I'm a skeptic and they kick me off. I mean, or I admit I saw a shadow person and they kicked me off, right? But no, I was just a kid. I was like 5 or 6. I know that age because of which bedroom I was in when it happened. And I woke up and wanted a glass of water. And luckily for me, I could see that my dad was standing at the foot of the bed. So I asked him for a glass of water. I mean, all I could see was his outline. It was just a shadowy outline of a person directly at the foot of my bed. And I asked him for water. And instead of saying anything, he was just silent. And I said, Daddy, can I have a glass of water? And nothing happened. And then I said, Daddy? And then I just started screaming because why would my dad not answer me? Why is he standing at the foot of the bed? It's terrifying. Well, then I was screaming. And then my dad burst into the room and turned the light on. And there was nobody there, Dave. Which really did not make me any calmer. And I was trying to explain to my dad.
No kidding, Blake. Do tell.
I was trying to explain to my dad that I had seen him at the foot of the bed and now he was here. And it was, you know, I don't know what it was like to be my parent, but it couldn't have been fun because I read way too many things and I was into monsters and ghosts, and so I was constantly scaring myself. But yeah, I definitely saw a shadow person. I just now, as an adult skeptic, I think it was some sort of dream related, you know, almost like the hypnopompic sort of things. It's a very natural thing to wake up and see things. It's not that weird. It's scary.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very natural. So.
Mm-hmm.
Not fun.
No, it was a shadow person, Blake. Just own it.
What if you had a shadow glass of water and I drank it, Dave? What would have happened?
That would have been awesome, right? If the shadow person would have brought you the glass of water, that would be it.
That would be the best.
I also try to deflect fear because I think we live in a place of fear that's when you cause more problems. And I've often mentioned to people, you're right, when I talk to them, when do they notice these shadow people the most? In their bedroom, which on the surface is terrifying. What do you mean in the bedroom? You saw him in the bedroom? But I often tell people, I go, isn't it funny? Probably 99%, no kidding you, will tell me that they eventually just kind of roll over and go to sleep. But, Blake, if you woke up and Dave Schrader was standing at the end of your bed at night, you wouldn't just go, and then roll over and go to bed. So it can't be that inherently evil because you would think that the fight or flight survival instinct would kick in at that point. So I tell people, you know what? Maybe that is our guardian angels. Maybe those are the watchers. We're our most prone, if you believe in the supernatural, while we're sleeping. If our soul leaves our body and dreams are nothing more than astral projection, maybe they're there to watch sentinel over us to make sure that nothing hurts our body or gets into us. So, you know, that seemed to make a lot of the people I talked to a lot more comfortable with it. But I find not so much that the shadow people phenomena exists. I find the reactions to it to be the most compelling to me.
Yeah, I think skepticism, if you think about it as a currency in the marketplace of ideas, right? We have a hard time selling because our stories aren't that comforting, Dave.
Right.
They're interesting, and a lot of them can be demonstrably sort of shown. I hate to say proven because science is always provisional. It can always be overturned with different evidence, right? But there's some pretty reliable ideas out there that we can think of as true, right? And unfortunately, they tend to contradict our sort of default positions. Like I have a reliable perception, Dave. What I see, I know what I saw. And if you become a really deep reading skeptic, you'd stop trusting your own vision. You stop trusting your own hearing, and it can be really disorienting and disconcerting. And I don't want anybody to have to go through that. But what I do like to say is, you know, you don't have to go down the rabbit hole I went down. You can just find out some of these tools and use them to sort of evaluate the things you're curious about. And that's probably enough for most people. I'm happy where I'm at now, but I had a pretty painful journey of going from being a believer to a deep skeptic. So I'm very honest and open about that.
Well, Blake, thank you for sharing some of that journey. And we'd love for you to come back and talk to us more in the future. Before I let you go, we're talking again with the host of Monster Talk, which is a science show about monsters. We'll have a link up to that so that you can find it as well right here on our podcast so that you got another great show to tune into and listen to as a resource. Whether you just want to listen and mock him like you skeptics do with my show, listening me to mock me, either way, it works out great. Tune in. It still pays us the same. What about black-eyed kids? This is a phenomenon that's really been kind of a cool, creepy, freaky story over the last, you know, 5-6 years it's been developing. What do you make of cases like that?
Well, you know, there's a case zero for black-eyed kids, right? And so when you're talking about a supernatural thing, I'm going to use the word viral. Like there's this idea of memes. Everybody knows memes, right? Where it's internet memes, cats, pictures, whatever. That actually comes from a Richard Dawkins book called The Selfish Gene, where they talk about memetics as an idea, like an idea that can follow sort of evolutionary patterns. It can be copied, it can mutate, and it can spread. And so his thought was maybe biology, DNA, and genes are not the only thing that copy and spread and mutate. And if you use that as an idea, like a little nugget, then you can look at memetics as a way of explaining how these ideas spread. When you look at the black-eyed kids, you get a guy who has this sighting and he posts it on the internet. My personal skeptical belief is that's a fictional story that he wrote and posted. That being said, it's taken on a cultural life. So I don't think it's a tulpa. That's not what I'm talking about. What I mean is that people are experiencing odd things, and I don't know if it's a shared fiction, you know, or if they're really experiencing these things as a genuine thing that they perceive, but the stories are following a really well-worn path to spread and mutate. People are taking these monsters and they're telling new stories and coming up with new lore about them. I have to say, as a fan of horror, I really enjoy reading these black-eyed kids stories. And when you do an episode on black-eyed kids, I always tune in because I love to hear the stories. I love to hear the ones where people, what happens when they come in the house? What happens when you do let them in? And the way they follow some sort of, you know, traditional European sort of tropes about they have to be invited, you know. Even vampires, if you look at vampire lore, it isn't what we think of it now. There's been so much change. Even if you look at Dracula, so much of the stuff that we think of as being part of Dracula has been added by movies and things. We're never in the original novel, right? And then so much of what happens in Dracula was picked up from like Varney the Vampire and the Penny Dreadfuls. And it's just we take monsters, we mutate them, we make better monsters, and it's going to keep happening. If you look at my friends Daniel Loxton and Don Prothero wrote a book about cryptozoology, and it's called Abominable Science. I would recommend it if you're interested in cryptids in particular, because it does a really deep dive into the history of these monsters. And there's this pattern where people pick up stuff from movies. And there's a lot of evidence that the Loch Ness Monster was directly influenced by King Kong. There's a lot of evidence Chupacabra was directly influenced by Species. There's many, many monsters like this where they come up in our culture, but they have a really close antecedent in popular culture and fiction. And so when you release a story on the internet, it's going to grow and spread if it's got the right DNA, or in this case, mimetic material, whatever you want to call it. That's just one way of thinking about it. But cult stories grow, spread, mutate, and change. And again, I may not believe they're true, but I love them. So that's where I'm at.
Fascinating stuff, Blake. It's a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for being a part of our world and sharing your insights and doing it in such a respectful way. And we'd love to talk with you again someday. So when you've got some more topics you want to cover, reach out and let me know. And everybody go check out Monster Talk. We've got a link up to that. We'll be back tomorrow. We've got so much more to discuss here on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.
Does Friendly have a taste? If it does, it's probably like Hello's peppermint-flavored anti-plaque and whitening toothpaste. Brush away plaque, show tartar who's boss, and remove surface stains to naturally whiten. Hello's thoughtful and flavor-forward products make brushing your teeth feel like a confetti-filled bathroom dance party. So say hello to Hello with the always cruelty-free, never tested on animals toothpaste that's made to spread smiles. Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.